Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Tonight, Aaron?
I'm okay, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing great. Bill Cosby was found guilty. Tex MacGyver was found guilty.
The Golden State Killer will be found guilty, right?
Yeah. There you go.
Well, we're hopeful. Because of a few messages that have come in the past week, it got me thinking that we should let you all know where our social media is. If you want to find us on Instagram, it's at Generation Y Podcast. If you want to find us on Facebook, it's at facebook.com/TheGenerationYPodcast. And our Twitter is at GenYPod.
And you guys heard that we would be changing our format up a little bit in the past. That doesn't mean we're not going to be a true crime podcast or that Aaron's firing me and replacing me. No, we're playing around with moving ads to different spots, hopefully to be a little less annoying or intrusive. Also, we're going to be doing more mini-sodes for our Patreon, things like that. But I guess that wasn't clear the first time I said it. So, yeah. Also, we had a Generation Y app, like mobile app, that is now gone. And our old website will be gone. But yeah, that's just an app that we had. So that's going away. You can still find us on Stitcher, Overcast, and whatever your favorite podcatching app is. So please go out there and subscribe on any of those. But yeah, if you used our branded app, yeah, it's going away. And there was only like, I don't know, 1,000 of you or less that were using it. So it's cool.
And none of you will have heard what he just said.
There you go.
Generation Y listeners, we're hoping you could help us out. We have a survey. It's quick. It won't take too much of your time, and it supports the show. We just need you to go to wondery.com/survey and fill it out for us. That's wondery.com/survey. Thank you so much.
Today's episode is brought to you by eHarmony. If you've tried or you're trying online dating, chances are you've run into lazy text messages, dead-end conversations, random matches that don't turn into dates. But have you seen the success stories from eHarmony? Real people finding real matches with eHarmony. Here are some testimonials from Lisa and Mark. We never thought we'd meet somebody online that was so compatible, and we are so grateful that we were able to find each other. Bruce and Lori say don't settle for anything less, and you too will meet the one that will complete your life. eHarmony has helped over a million people find their perfect match. They use decades of science, data, and psychology research to send you the right matches. It's very easy to use, so go out and sign up now. Our listeners get a free month with eHarmony when they sign up for a 3-month subscription. Enter the code Y at checkout. That's W-H-Y. Stop waiting and start your journey to a satisfying, meaningful relationship. It can be fun to play around with online dating apps, but when you're ready to fall in love with somebody and have a meaningful relationship, there's one app that's built to bring you real love, eHarmony. Come see how eHarmony can change your life. Go to eHarmony.com and get started. Enter the code Y at checkout. That's W-H-Y.
So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we are talking about the case of Josh and Susan Powell.
And a lot of you know about this case. And for those of you that do not, I would say that this is one of the more screwed up, twisted stories I've ever heard. So it's a story of Josh Powell, and he goes on a camping trip with his sons. And when they return, his wife is missing. He thinks that she ran off with somebody or been abducted. He doesn't know. But after that point, things start to spiral out of control until they crash and burn.
Let's talk about who these people are. You have Susan Cox. Her parents were Chuck and Judy. She had 3 siblings. They were all sisters. Susan in particular, she seemed to be closest to her sister Denise. They're both really into animals. Susan was known to be an aspiring cosmetologist. She loved to style and color hair. She would give people manicures and pedicures, usually her friends and family. And so sometimes people would regret, not because she was bad at what she did, but she definitely wanted to make people look good. And sometimes that was a little different than what they wanted.
So but, she would go overboard with a nail color or something.
Or a little overboard with the scissors.
Yeah. Aww.
But she definitely loved doing this kind of thing. And in fact, her sister Denise, she shared this in a way because when they were younger, they came up with a plan. And the plan was to open a business someday known as Beauty and Your Beast. And it was where you could go get your hair done or get salon stuff done. And then you would bring your pet and then they would get treated to a salon treatment too.
That's kind of fun.
So it was a really cool idea, but of course it never did come to fruition. Susan would later go to cosmetology school. They said that she just was the kind of person that would light up a room and people really took to her and she always wanted everyone to be happy. Just one of those good people that you hear about sometimes. The other person at the center of this case is Josh Powell. While Susan has this great family, great life, Josh Powell didn't quite have that.
He was born January 20th, 1976. Same year I was born.
Yeah, so he's 5 years older than Susan.
He grew up in Spokane, Washington, Washington State. And the birthplace known for Father's Day. A little foreshadowing here.
Josh's parents didn't really get along. And over time, it just got worse and worse to where they were divorced. It seemed as though Josh really preferred to stay with his father, but it was a very, very difficult relationship because according to his mother, you know, Steve Powell took it out on Josh worse than any of the other kids. So he had various siblings. There was Michael, there was Alina, there was Jennifer. Of those, Josh was the one who got hit by his dad. It was rough.
And didn't they kidnap the kids from each other?
Yeah.
His parents would separate and one would want to see the children and the other would be like, no, you're not seeing the kids this week. So then they would go and kidnap the kids and take them. This is just one Amber Alert after another from these two parents that Josh is being brought up by.
Now, it's quite possible that this is because he was experiencing a rough household. But as a teenager, he killed pet gerbils and attempted to take his own life. And he also threatened his mom with a knife. So some violence there, mm-hmm. showing through in his teen years. Also at the center of this case is religion, because both these families started off pretty religious.
Yeah, they were Mormons, Church of Latter-day Saints.
And Josh's father, Steve, at some point decided he hated this religion.
You grow up in it as a child. You're still a part of it. So Josh was still a Mormon, but he will soon grow to be like his father.
Yeah, his father would rant about this church. Of course, he would say some pretty awful things about his wife. Now, this is not uncommon when couples separate or divorce, but he was pretty mean-spirited. And then his wife would return with, well, yeah, he's accusing me of being a witch, because she kept some herbal books and just some of the things that she was reading he considered to be wrong. But on her end, she would say, oh, well, Steve has pornography.
Yeah, which is worse. Somebody that keeps, you know, a book about cloves and spices around as opposed to pornography. But, you know, double standard.
Yeah, it's tricky to figure out what exactly is going on here, because when you get into who has custody and all of this, if you're not following any rules, we know where that goes. With this couple, with the way they're acting, it's because they don't like each other at all. One thing that came out was Josh and his brother, they were being exposed to pornography because, well, their dad was leaving it out for them. He was showing it to them. So there's definitely a contrast between these two people, between Susan Cox and Josh Powell. They're going to meet each other at some point, but before that ever happened, Josh Powell showed up over at the Cox's house, and it's because Susan's older sister was going to prom, and he wanted to show up to take her out on a date.
But she's already going to prom with somebody else, right?
Judy tried telling him, Susan's mom tried telling him, look, she's out, it's prom. I don't know what you're going for here, but she's already got a date. Well, instead of leaving, Josh just let himself into their house and he sat down and started to talk. And this is something that anybody who ever met Josh said, that he would just talk and talk and talk until people's ears literally fell off. Well, not literally, but I'm sure everyone's met someone like this who can just keep talking. And at some point you're almost like, why are you still talking? You know?
I have to say that I'm very patient and very tolerant of people, but after 20, 30 minutes and you haven't gotten to the punchline, I'm probably out. You're going to hear me say, I have to go return some videotapes.
So eventually Susan's dad, Chuck, gets home. He's like, what are you doing here? And so, you know, his wife is like, hey, he showed up and he won't leave. And meanwhile, Josh is still talking away. And so Chuck tries to interrupt him and just say, you need to leave my house. And he didn't right away. It took a while. So you can imagine that at some point when Susan talks to her parents and says, I met this guy. Well, that didn't go over too well.
And they met at a dance at the church, right?
Yeah. There was an LDS Latter-day Saints singles event. The way I understood it was Susan, you know, looked at it as, well, it's something to go do. You know, and who knows, maybe she would meet somebody. And so she goes to the singles event, and it's in 2000. Of course, she comes back. She lets them know that she's met this guy. And she tells them who he is, and they're thinking, no. They don't want him back in their house, you know? Yeah,
they're going to have to talk to him again.
It's a year later when they get married just outside Portland. They were married in Verndale, Washington, which is a suburb of Spokane near the Idaho border. It's April 6th, 2001 when they get married. And before this all happened, Josh met with Chuck. You know, Chuck's in that position of, I love my daughter, I want what's best for her, and this guy is not what's best for her. But on the other hand, if I try to push him away too hard, then I could lose her.
Yeah, you're just pushing your daughter away at that point.
Relationships can be so difficult, especially when you're factoring in parents and
the best thing really to do is try to manage. And that's what they're doing here. So he sat down with Josh and he just said, Josh, you're going to marry my daughter. What are you going to provide? What are you bringing to the table, essentially? Josh, I guess, he had a lot of good answers. Chuck was talking to his wife later and he just basically said, you know, I don't think I like this guy, but, you know, he's going to do this. He's going to do that. He's going to work and he has a place. So what am I supposed to say? Am I supposed to tell her she can't marry this guy that she loves?
And yes.
Well, yeah, we could say that. But as a parent, you have that fine line of you want them to be independent, but you also feel like you can see things better than they can. So that's what they're wrestling with. But Susan and Josh, they move into this apartment together. Well, Josh isn't good at keeping jobs.
So he's not delivering on all these promises he's made.
No, the disgusting thing is, Steve Powell, his father, when he was at the wedding, he told one of his kids that Susan wasn't going to stay with Josh. She was going to divorce him. He already could tell. And he also said she's not going to bring any real money into the household. How is she going to take care of Josh? Even Steve knows Josh can't hold a job. And so if he's going to marry someone, he thinks that Josh should be getting a wife who can take care of him. Let's be clear about what Steve means here, that his son Josh deserves a woman who will take care of the house and bring home the money.
Because he knows Josh is not going to do anything.
Okay. But it is his son, and he loves his son. Mm. So he deserves someone that will take care of him. Moving forward, because Josh can't keep a job, he's not good with money, they have to move into his dad's house. And at this point, you know, his father doesn't live with his wife. I mean, they're separated, they're divorced. So they're moving in with Steve Powell. And, well, that doesn't go well either, because Steve develops an interest in Susan that goes beyond, oh, wow, what a wonderful daughter-in-law that I have here.
Yeah, he will walk up behind her when she's in the kitchen washing dishes and slip his hand up her shirt, touch her, and say things to her.
It's an uncomfortable situation. Susan does her best to stand by her husband and to keep everything on an even keel. She just can't live with this. And she's mortified by it. So she goes to her husband and says, we can't live here anymore. In fact, I want to move far, far, far away.
They leave his father's house and they move several states over to Utah. January 19th, 2005, they will have their first child, Charles Joshua Powell. He goes by Charlie, and he's born in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Now, to give you an idea, when they had left his father's house, Susan made it clear that she didn't want him to have anything to do with his father because, you know, she was just so disgusted with his behavior and she thought he was a bad influence on her husband. So for a while there, he didn't really have anything to do with his father. When Charlie was born, he ended up finally telling his dad, but it was well after the fact. Of course, his dad was hurt by this. But according to Susan, up until the birth of Charlie, and after they moved away from his father, she felt that Josh was a very good husband. So like when they would give money to the church, which he was kind of suffering from the same thing his dad did in terms of he had some issues with the church. But because he knew it was important for her, he supported giving the church money. I think they call it tithing, something like that, where there's a certain amount that you're 10%. supposed to give. Yeah, in the church, she also is a member of the choir. He would hold her hand. It was a more loving relationship. I think that was one of the ideas, was get him away from his dad and then establish a new life somewhere and then they can work on themselves. But then comes Charlie. According to Susan, this is when Josh's ways start going back to the ways of the past. And this is something her mother brought up too. She felt like Susan wasn't marrying Josh because she loved him. She was marrying him because she thought she could help him.
Yeah, it's called the Messiah complex, where you want to fix people. You know, you can date somebody. There's all kinds of red flags and stuff, but you're like, oh, I can fix them. guess what? You can't fix them.
Yeah. Because I'm around, they'll be happier. I can make their life better than if I wasn't around.
But you are not a therapist. You are not
qualified.
Exactly. So you can't fix them. Just walk away and find somebody that doesn't have as many red flags.
But being a member of this church, I think the term they use there is ward. She has a lot of supportive ladies that attend this church too. And so they spend some time around each other, helping each other out. I guess even though Susan's not quite happy with her husband at this point, she is doing the best she can. And I think she's trying to be understanding, like maybe he's just going through a rough patch. It, you know, he'll come around.
And she's still faithful to the church. So she's being a good wife. She's being a good mother. That's her belief system. But Josh, he's not really going to church much anymore and he's becoming resentful. So a big divide is happening.
In 2007, the couple has their second child.
Braden Timothy Powell. He was also born in Salt Lake City, January 2nd, which is right next to Charlie. I mean, they're both born in January. So it's said that she knows when the conception happened because Josh would hold back affection and sex from her. So she knows exactly the date that Charles and Braden were conceived.
Josh told people about this too. He told his family, if I'm angry with Susan, you know, I'll just tell her we're not going to have sex for a while. So he would definitely withhold affection. Susan, of course, is trying to get him to be interested in her, but there's something going on with Josh where she just can't break through. As time is going by and, you know, getting into 2007, getting into 2008, she's reaching a point where she's talking with her family and she's telling them about the issues. And they're saying, look, you may not be happy about a divorce, but sometimes you have to do what you have to do. We really support you. So you need to leave him.
Hey, we're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
There was a video I saw on YouTube of Susan documenting the things of value in the house. And this is something you do for life insurance, homeowner insurance. And it's very telling because I almost feel like it was subconscious, but she's pointing out all the things that are of value. And that's computers that Josh owns. It's remote control cars and other toys that are all, they all belong to him. She goes down into the basement and they have thousands of pounds of wheat, which I'm like, what are you doing? Are you planning for the apocalypse or something? Like, what is this wheat for? And come to find out, you don't really see her videotape any of her own belongings until the very end of the tape. And she shows her jewelry, and her little jewelry stand is broken. And she says, oh yeah, well, Josh broke this jewelry stand when he was mad at me one day. But nothing of value in the house belongs to her, yet she's the one that's working, and not Josh so much. But he's giving her the allowance. He's controlling the money, and he's dictating what's bought. And of course, if it's a remote control car or some idiotic hobby that he comes up with that week, oh, it's getting bought. But if it's anything for Susan, and she makes a comment about her makeup and how she's not allowed to buy Mary Kay or anything that's expensive, you can see the level of control that he has now pressed upon her.
Yeah, he controlled the bank account. He also controlled which groceries she could buy. So he would give her a list. It wouldn't just be the item listed. It would also have a price next to it. And if the price varied by more than just like basically, a, you know, 5 cents or something like that, she wasn't allowed to buy it. And if she did, she would be in big trouble when she got back.
Well, I mean, he's got to manage the money, Aaron, the money that she's bringing home.
But the other thing he did was he put limits on how often the kids could eat and what they could eat.
Which, wow, that's a whole other level. You're supposed to just give your kids food. Like, that's the whole thing, right? Is, oh, eat, kids. Like, please, eat more. But no, he's limiting their food intake. And one of them actually gets diagnosed with malnutrition, right?
Well, that's because they were only being fed once a day. Josh told Susan at one point, after Charlie was diagnosed with malnutrition, he gets one meal a day at daycare. That's all he needs. You're not wasting my food on him because he's just going to poop it out. Now, we should add in that Josh isn't hurting for food.
No. Dictators usually aren't.
And Susan wasn't allowed to buy meat. They're just not getting... And I know you can live a vegan diet and you don't have to have meat, but that's not the kind of house this was. You know, I know some vegan people, they live a very healthy life, but this was not about health. This was about the money. And really, when it came down to it, it was about control.
Yeah, absolutely. And Susan was getting more and more afraid of Josh. She understood her place and she didn't like it, but she knew that she couldn't just take the kids. And she knew that she didn't want to just file a divorce because she was afraid of his reaction and his response to that.
But things were beginning to change. She was talking about kind of an ultimatum that she was thinking about giving to Josh because she couldn't live that way. Even though she started off trying to help this guy, I think she realized eventually that this wasn't a situation that she had any control over. Remember, going to the grocery store, just feeding her kids, whatever it was, Josh set every rule, set every boundary. He would not let her have freedom. She didn't have freedom. There were a lot of rules implemented at the Powell house. So eventually, she started to talk to him about, you know, something needs to change. We can't live this way. Not only did he have control over the grocery list and whether she got a kiss or not, or how much she was allowed to feed the kids, when Charlie was first about to be born, Josh wouldn't take her to the hospital. He said, you have to have your parents take you.
I'm doing something.
Yeah.
He was working on his computer, actually.
Yeah, it was really important, whatever it was, on his computer. It was really, really important. And her giving birth was not important, apparently.
She also wasn't allowed to use the family car without permission, but she ends up having to call her parents and they take her to the hospital. And Josh shows up hours later, whatever his little computer task, social media thing was completed. So he wasn't even there basically for the birth of his son.
So we've well established here that Josh comes from a rocky home. Susan's home life wasn't like that at all, but they get married. They have a couple of children. They're off to a really rough start. Susan is starting to talk to Josh about this. She is starting to tell him things have to change. What happens next, Justin?
Well, it's Sunday night, December 6th. At around 8:30 p.m., neighbors see Josh return home and park in the garage. Later on that night, other neighbors hear a car alarm going off from inside the garage, and it goes off for several minutes, and then it's turned off. But Josh claims that he takes his two sons out for a camping trip, which, hey, you know, father wants to take his kids out for a camping trip. That's fine and dandy. But it's December. It's freezing outside. And it's 12:30 at night before they get on the road and drive to a campsite. And it's covered in snow and ice. Really weird camping trip. But according to Josh, he doesn't really think about what he's doing. He just, if that sounds like a good idea, then hey, they're going to go do it. And his sons like to eat s'mores in the morning. But I'm questioning the whole s'mores part now because, well, they weren't allowed to have food. So, yeah, anyways. So they leave and they go on this camping trip. Because Josh and Susan weren't planning a camping trip, well, they didn't call in to work the next day. So they didn't tell their places of employment we're not going to be there. They didn't tell daycare that the kids weren't going to be there. So Josh is taking the kids on this camping trip, and Susan is staying home and sleeping.
That's according to Josh.
Yeah, this is all according to Josh. So, yeah.
9 a.m., and this is on that Monday. Their daycare provider, Debbie Caldwell, is wondering what's going on because this is not normal. And she can't reach them. She calls Susan's employer. Then she calls Josh's. She calls Josh Powell's mother and sister. The West Valley City Police are finally called. They do a welfare check. They're nervous. They don't know where anybody's at. No one's answering their phones. People should be at work at this point. Kids should be at daycare. So they break a window to get into the home. They find two fans. They're box fans, blowing on a particular spot on the carpet in the home that is by a chair that Susan usually sits in.
Well, I'm sure somebody spilled a drink and they cleaned it up and the box fans are drying the carpet, right?
The stereo was also left on with the volume up quite a bit. As they're looking around the home, they're finding things that they believe that Susan would have brought with her if she had left the house.
They find her purse, her ID, her wallet, everything. All of her stuff.
Now, they know that the Powells only have one vehicle, and it's a 2005 light blue Town and Country minivan. So they put out, you know, an APB for this minivan, all points bulletin, which is letting other precincts and other departments know, hey, keep an eye out for this vehicle because we really need to find out where these people are at and check and make sure they're okay. Now, later that day, Josh's sister, Jennifer, who she's very concerned. She's been trying to do her best to track them down. She finds someone who saw the couple on Sunday. And this woman's name is Jovanna. And she sang in the choir with Susan at church. Jovanna calls Josh at close to 3 p.m., but she didn't get an answer. And then she had her son call Josh. Now, her son sometimes babysat Charlie and Braden. He calls and they think Josh picked up, but her son, Alex, got nervous and hung the phone up. Jovanna grabbed the phone and just called him right back. And Josh answered and she said, "Where are you? What's going on? You know, the police are looking for you now." And Josh said, "I'm just driving." Look, that's actually a good answer from him because he would sometimes just get in his car and just take off and just drive aimlessly. So it's not really that crazy, except for the fact that he's not at work, his wife's not at work, and the kids aren't at daycare. So something's going on. He's asked, "Where is Susan?" And he said, "Well, she's at work." And Jovanna's like, "No, she's not." And he goes, "Oh, I thought this was Sunday." And she's like, you know, it's Monday. And his excuse is, you know, he's not going to church regularly. For him, it's like, oh, I forgot which day it was.
But does she work on Sundays? It still doesn't really add up in my mind.
Before 6 o'clock that night, Jennifer, Josh's sister, speaks with Josh on the phone. She had tried calling him for the last 20, 30 minutes to no avail. And then finally she gets him on the line and Josh says, I'm at work. And Jennifer says, well, where are the kids then? Where is Susan? Meanwhile, Chuck Cox is sitting next to Jennifer. This is Susan's dad. And he's trying to listen in. Josh just isn't cooperating here. He says the boys are safe and he doesn't know where Susan is. And then he says something really odd. He asks Jennifer how much she knows.
What?
A very strange, strange comment. He asks her, he says, how much do you know? So around that time, Josh Powell and his sons return home. A detective talks with Josh while he's parked his minivan. He's looking in past Josh into the front area of the vehicle, and he sees that there are two cell phones up there. He sees one that's plugged in charging and another one nearby it. And he's thinking, that's weird. Why are there two cell phones here? Josh Powell is taken to the West Valley City Police Station for questioning along with his kids. And he tells the detectives that he went camping and they made s'mores, but that he forgot the chocolate bars. So they just had roasted marshmallows on graham crackers. They asked Josh, where's your wife? Where is Susan? And when did you last see her? But he's not cooperating. He doesn't really have anything to say. And so they ask him, do you mind if we search your vehicle? And he agrees to that. When they look in his vehicle, they find a generator, they find snacks, they find a humidifier, a circular saw, but they don't find anything having to do with camping. And when they ask him about the generator, he says that Susan told him that he should bring the generator because it's going to be cold out there. You know, when he goes camping.
I don't really know how this generator is going to warm him up unless he has a space heater, but whatever.
They get the cell phones. One of them is Josh's cell phone and the other is Susan's. They ask him, why do you have Susan's cell phone? And he said that when he was at the house, he had picked it up to look something up because it was nearby. And then he must have mistakenly just put it in his pocket, just, you know, not thinking about it, just put it in his pocket.
He's taking this random camping trip in the middle of December when it's freezing outside with his children. He comes back home. The cops are waiting for him, and he just happens to have taken his wife's phone also. Okay. I'm just really painting the picture here.
The other odd thing is both of the cell phones were missing their SIM cards.
Well, I mean, sometimes they just fall out, right?
Yeah. I mean, how else do you explain this?
God.
Later that evening, after 9, Josh returned home with his kids. Some people on his street noticed that Josh was moving back and forth from his van all night, his minivan. He was doing it the next morning as well. And they said it appeared as though he was carrying things back and forth and that he was cleaning. Why is he cleaning the minivan? Who knows, right? Maybe some of the marshmallows spilled out or, you know, I don't know. The next morning, 11 a.m., Chuck Cox gets a call from Josh Powell. Chuck knows his daughter's been missing since December 6th. And at least by all accounts, it seems like that's when she went missing. He very much wants to hear what Josh has to say. Now, Josh tells Chuck, says, hey, Susan is missing. And he's going to be interviewed by police again. And Chuck said that Josh sounded upset on this call. Chuck just isn't buying it. This is the, you know, what did he do to my daughter kind of situation. But he's not going to say anything that would alarm Josh because, well, I guess it's keep your enemies closer.
Well, he still has the two children.
On December 8th that evening, sometime after, later in the evening, from when he talked to Chuck Cox, Josh had been interviewed by the police. He left the police station, got in a cab, and went to Salt Lake City International Airport. And while he's there, he rents a car. Then he just drives away. Around that same time, his dad called into work and said, hey, I'm going to be out the next couple of days. I'm sick.
So he's got a minivan, but he's renting a car. Okay, got it.
And while he has this rental car, he's going to put over 800 miles on it. One of the things he does, he drives over to a city which is 90 miles north of West Valley City, and he purchases and activates a new cell phone.
That's worth driving 90 miles to get a cell phone. Got it.
So if you are suspicious of Josh Powell, you're probably thinking he takes off, putting all these miles on the car, and his dad is missing at the same time. Maybe they went somewhere together.
Who's watching the kids? Who's taking care of the house? Why is he taking this trip right after his wife has disappeared? It just seems very out of the ordinary, especially for a guy that's so concerned about money.
Well, family has the kids, so they're okay at this point. But what is Josh doing? One of the things that comes up is maybe he didn't go to Simpson Springs. Maybe that's a lie. And so as part of this traveling that he's doing here, maybe he actually went back to where Susan is, or at least her body, if she's deceased.
His family, his father's helping him.
Yeah, someone asked Josh's sister, Alina, what's going on with your dad? Why did he take that time off? And she said it was actually bereavement because he was so upset that Susan was missing. So he wasn't even sick. You know, he's just upset that Susan's missing.
I didn't know you could take bereavement for that, but okay.
Well, he can lie and say that he's sick. December 9th, the police serve a search warrant on the Powell residence. They start removing all kinds of things, boxes, bags, a computer. They find drops of blood near the front door. They also find a key that fits a safe deposit box at a bank near the office that Susan worked at. This is something that I found really chilling, is they take this key, they open up this safe deposit box, and inside is this note that was kind of folded over and I think even stapled.
Yeah.
And when they pull this thing apart, it's dated June 28th, 2008. So this is the prior year. And Susan wrote, "If I die, it may not be an accident, even if it looks like one. Take care of my boys. For mine and my children's safety, I feel the need to have a paper trail at work, which would not be accessible to my husband. It is an open fact that we have life insurance policies of over $1 million if we die in the next 4 years."
So we got life insurance policies. We got a husband that doesn't even really seem fazed by his wife going missing that went out on a camping trip. Okay.
And Susan was talking, like I said, to Josh and telling him things need to change. And she would give him some deadlines. She would say, you have to change things by 2008. Then she would change it to 2009. But she was letting him know, I will leave you. As part of this investigation that develops, they would learn from diaries that she kept or emails that she sent to some friends that she felt that Josh had the power because he could do something to their kids.
Well, that note that they found was what you felt was very chilling. It's what his children said that sent the chill up my back. And they asked the kids, like, hey, tell us about the camping trip. And Charlie said that he and his brother, dad and mom, went camping to have s'mores. He also said that his mom was at work. And then a little later, he said that his mom didn't come home with them from the camping trip.
Yeah, and so they asked him, well, where did she go? He started to describe where she went, but yeah, I couldn't really make sense of it. I think he said something like there were crystals there.
Yeah, so there are mine shafts in the area around some camping sites, but he said he took the kids down to the Pony Express Trail, so that's where the campsite is.
So it's pretty clear that Steve Powell took off with his kids around 12:30 in the morning. And then when he returned, Susan was gone. So with this information, because Josh tells them that he went to this Simpson Springs area, this Pony Express Trail area, law enforcement goes there and they conduct a search. There's a lot of fresh snowfall and they can't figure out where his campsite was. I don't know how many times they asked Josh, but they ask him a great number of times, can you just go with us and show us where your campsite was? Or can you draw us a map? Can you do something to let us know where you were so we can just check it out?
Nope.
And Josh doesn't really have anything to say about that. You know this. This is like a common thing, but police officers often have that gut instinct when they're speaking to someone of whether they're telling the truth or whether they're lying, right?
Yeah.
Well, Josh just isn't talking. And this is a guy who you normally can't shut up.
Yeah.
And now he's just not saying anything.
Yeah, there's multiple interviews you can see with him where like news reporters will be waiting for him when he pulls up to his house and they ask him questions and he's just at a loss for words. He's like, I'm just trying, and he just doesn't go anywhere with it. And again, this is a guy that would talk people into a corner. And I realize, hey, a husband, a father just loses his wife. It might freak him out, but he doesn't look freaked out. And again, I don't want to put any emphasis on how somebody responds or acts after something like this happens, but he is completely and utterly, in my mind, not even trying to act like he's concerned at all, whether it be an act or real. He just doesn't seem, he seems more annoyed when people are asking him questions.
The police continue their search. They can't locate wherever supposedly they did the camping thing. But then again, you know, if you think about what they got from the minivan, he didn't have any camping gear. There was nothing about the minivan that suggested that they had gone and went on a camping trip. So this is not a good situation. There's a woman missing. Every day that goes by, you know, things look more bleak. Meanwhile, her friends are starting to organize events to raise awareness and to get the word out. And what does Josh do? Josh manages to help pass out some flyers. And other than that, yeah, he's complaining that he doesn't have a computer. So he borrows a laptop from somebody, you know, goes over to their house and uses it. He says that he's going to launch a website to help get people involved in the search for his wife.
Raise awareness, yeah.
Yeah, but wow, when this website launches, it's not anything to do with Susan being missing, really, is it?
No, he goes on attack and he goes after the Cox family and even goes so far as to make allegations against his wife, which that's sort of the opposite of what you want to do when your wife's missing, right?
Yeah, he also rants against the LDS church. So obviously, and this is from what the law enforcement officers are saying, Josh seems very unconcerned about where his wife is, doesn't seem to care. Meanwhile, her family, despite all the pressure and all the anger coming from Josh, they're trying to maintain that, you know, the press should leave Josh alone and we just need to find our daughter. And it's, again, because they're afraid that they might drive him away. I mean, early on here, Chuck Cox hugged Josh. And when he was doing that, I mean, you know what he was wanting to do.
Yeah.
Right? That goes without saying. But he holds back because he doesn't want Josh to flee. And that's one of the worries, is that Josh will just take off. So they need to keep him around. People are doing their best to keep him comfortable. But there's something going on with Josh. I mean, he's getting more and more like sullen and angry.
Withdrawn.
Yeah. And he's not cooperating. On December 15th or on December 14th, Josh hires a defense attorney. He's skipping more interviews with the West Valley City Police. On the next day, December 15th, he does provide a DNA sample to the authorities. And what do they label him?
They label him a person of interest. A person of interest is a term used by law enforcement that identifies someone involved in a criminal investigation, but has not been arrested or formally accused of a crime. It has no legal meaning. It doesn't mean anything. It's just somebody of interest in a case. Hey, you know, there's multiple people involved in a crime. Even though you might not have been the trigger man, you could still be considered a person of interest. So, but he is not a suspect. He is not a prime suspect. but you can find a lot of videos out there about this case because it happened so recently. But the divide between the Powell family and the Cox family begins to spill out into public. And of course, the Cox family is looking for their daughter, their sister, their family member. And they've set up all over town with flyers and signs. Well, they happen to set up in front of the grocery store, I guess, that Josh would frequent. But really, he doesn't frequent it because he would only send Susan to buy stuff and she wasn't allowed to buy anything. But whatever. Josh's father, Steve, he will show up and start berating Susan's father on camera in front of the news people and saying, why are you setting up here? You're slandering us. You're saying that we're the ones that are doing this to you. And you sure picked a great place to set up your missing person sign. And I'm sure in their minds that Josh is the prime suspect, but they're trying to raise awareness for Susan's disappearance. This has nothing to do with the Cox family, but they're going out and, along with that website, giving a counter narrative. It's really disgusting to see some of the things that they do.
We talked early on about how Susan was the breadwinner. Josh can't afford to keep the home. And that's where Susan's friends were saying, hey, why don't you just let us handle the kids and, you know, try to find work because you need to pay for rent, basically. And he said, I can't afford to pay you for daycare, so I'm not going to do it.
But they're offering.
Yeah, they're offering and they're trying to say, hey, we can work it out, whatever. But he doesn't care. He's saying, no, my family is going to help me with this, not you.
And there's no way I'm going to give my kids up to you. So it's a control thing.
Yeah, and there are these interviews that he does. He just talks to the media and he tells them, you know, that his kids are his world. Everything he does is for his children. But the kids are saying some really odd things to people. One of the boys said to a friend of Susan's, I hate my dad. But again, it's this situation where these people don't want to scare Josh away. You know, they're trying to stay close so that they can maybe get some information. Maybe they can get him to lighten up. Maybe he'll start to feel bad. But yeah, of course he's not going to, sorry, but they don't follow up with that. They don't ask the kids, tell us more. What do you mean by that?
Josh and his father start making allegations that Susan has run off with another missing individual in Utah named Stephen Kocher, who disappeared in Nevada. I mean, this is weird. Back in December of 2009, they claim that they ran off to Brazil together. So it's just this random, oh, she ran off with this other guy and they just kind of picked some random dude who's gone missing at the same time and said, oh, that's who she ran off with. But there's no connection between Stephen and Susan whatsoever. Now, this Stephen Kocher guy, his story is very interesting too. His disappearance is very mysterious. We have a lot of information about it. Maybe it'll be an episode we do in the future, but if you want to know more about it, check out the Insight podcast. It's their episode number 17, and they have a special guest, Marissa from The Vanished, on. They also start pulling Susan's diary entries and saying, oh, she was very promiscuous. You already heard that that Josh's father said that she was flirting with him. So she's now being pretty much blamed for her own disappearance because they're saying that she's ran off with other men. So not exactly the response that one would assume we would get from a father, from a husband.
And along the way here, the Cox family finally just says, screw it. You know, trying to play nice with Josh has not done any good. And they start speaking out about him. Josh filed a restraining order against Chuck Cox where he couldn't approach Josh or his grandsons, you know. So Chuck can't see his grandsons anymore. And that's, you know, this is a line being drawn in the sand. and Josh basically saying, leave me alone. And any effort he puts forth is, I mean, really just creating more division. August of 2011, West Valley City Police conduct a two-day search of abandoned mine shafts in Ely, Nevada. And they don't really release much information on it, but this is apparently connected to Susan Powell.
Well, remember what the child said? There were diamonds there or something?
He was talking about crystals, I think.
Yeah.
There is that concern that she was disposed of in a mine shaft, but they don't find anything. Meanwhile, Stephen Powell is continuing to talk about how he was in love with Susan Cox Powell, and he was talking about how flirtatious she was.
And he wrote her a song.
He had a name that he recorded under, Steve Chantry, and he wrote about 50 songs about Susan.
Hmm. And he has journal entries, too, that are all about Susan. But yeah, it's Susan who's the one that's flirting with him, right?
Right. And well, on August 25th of 2011, search warrants are served against his home. And well, they pull out boxes of photographs, of videos, computers. They even find some of Susan's childhood diaries. Now, one of the creepy things is that Steve Powell had about 17 notebooks filled with his desires for Susan Powell. And even in there, there's one entry where he records a conversation. He writes it down between himself and Alina, his own daughter, where Alina tells him, Dad, she's a player. She's leading you on. That's her game, you know? And so, you know, in Steve's mind, Susan is this woman who's flirting with him. And, you know, it's all her fault. She's leading him on. So they also find, though, hundreds of pictures, and they find videos. Apparently, Steve has been photographing and filming not just Susan, but other people without their knowledge, some of them children. He also, and this is pretty disgusting, but Steve Powell in his journals says that he masturbates twice a day to pictures of Susan Powell.
But because of these pictures of children, he has very inappropriate pictures of children. This allows the Cox family more ammo to try to get custody of these two boys that they feel are in harm's way. They feel that Josh is unstable and Josh has moved the kids in with his father. And what are some of the things that the children say about living with grandpa?
Well, they say that they sleep naked with their naked grandpa.
Hmm. So there's, to me, a clear and present danger here. But up until this point, Josh has only been a person of interest. And getting custody taken away from a parent is damn near impossible. As long as the children are being taken care of, as long as there's food and shelter, it's just really hard to get any sort of custody of children taken away. I guess this is the problem. I have a family member that was removed from the home, and other family members were reporting that the parent was out of work. The utilities were being shut off all the time. The child wasn't able to get to school to the point where the mom was taking the child out of school so she could drive her to a casino, so she could drink at the casino, things like that. None of these things got the child taken out of the home until one mention of drugs in the house, one mention of marijuana, and then those kids were taken out within 2 hours. So in this case, you would assume with Josh and his father that these kids would have had some sort of probable cause. They would have had some sort of reason. But up until that point, Josh has not been charged with anything. This is 2 years, two freaking years after the disappearance of his wife. He has not been charged. He is only a person of interest. They have nothing to pull these kids out of the house until they find all this stuff on his dad.
Yeah, and Steve Powell in Puyallup, Washington, was arrested September 22nd with 14 counts of voyeurism and possession of child pornography. And this is all based on what they seized in his house the month prior. The judge orders Josh and Susan's kids to be removed from the home and they're placed in protective custody. Now, Steve says, I'm not guilty, but he's being kept in jail.
And Josh is now fighting to get custody of his children back.
Chuck and Judy, they want these kids under their care.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
On September 28th, they get custody of Charlie and Braden.
But Josh still has visitation rights.
Yeah, but he has to undergo psychological evaluation and attend parenting classes, which is, I guess, their way of saying, hey, go get yourself checked out. Go through the motions here. This is serious.
It's better than nothing, sure. But he has to have supervised visits with his children after all of this vetting, psychological stuff. They go to a daycare center for the supervised visit. But of course, Josh's name and face is all over the newspapers, all over the TVs as being pretty much the prime suspect. So when he shows up to these supervised visits, there's other children there visiting with their parents. Well, now there's a mob of journalists and the news people waiting for Josh to come visit his kids. This becomes such a distraction to the daycare center that they decide to do supervised visits at Josh's home and not at the daycare center because there's just too much attention there, and the other parents are complaining about this distraction. And given supervised visits at the home are not uncommon, but thinking about the background in this case, thinking about who Josh is, this is a really bad decision to make because Josh has already said, these children are mine. No one else is going to have control over them. He's already under suspicion of his missing wife. And then we find out that his father's a pedophile? Like, come on. You know, just come on.
In 2012, a judge orders Josh Powell to undergo a psychosexual evaluation. This is all having to do with trying to really settle this custody status of these two kids who are 4 and 7 years old. Let's talk about the caseworker, the Child Protective Services worker who takes the boys to visit their father on Sunday, February 5th, 2012.
So their caseworker is Elizabeth Griffin Hall, and she has been tasked with taking the kids to Josh's new home, in their new home in Puyallup. And the boys actually seem somewhat excited to see their father, which is a good sign for her. And they pull up to the home and she opens the door to the car. Charlie and Braden run up to the house and Josh is waiting for them with the front door open. And she's trying to catch up with the kids, but you know, kids are pretty quick. And the kids go through the front door and Josh looks right at her and he slams the door in her face. Now, she knows the history of Josh. She knows that this isn't normal. So she starts pounding on the door, telling Josh to open the door. This is a supervised visit. But Josh is not unlocking the door. He is not doing anything for her. She hears Josh telling Charlie, "Hey, I have a big surprise for you." And when that door was slammed in her face, there was a gust or a waft of gasoline smell. So she's now very startled. She hears Braden crying, and she's hearing the boys in some sort of distress. And this is when she decides to call 911, which is pretty quick, and I applaud her for this. So she calls 911, and the operator picks up, and she's very clear and concise at the very beginning of the call. She says, "I am a caseworker. I am here doing a supervised visit, and the house belongs to Josh Powell." Now, the dispatcher is actually saying, "Hey, what's the address?" And she doesn't know the address off the top of her head, and so she has to go back to the car to get it. And she's trying to explain the situation for the first 2 minutes while she's looking for the address. The 911 dispatcher's a little dismissive, like, "You don't know the address of where you're at?" So finally she gets the address, and then the 911 dispatcher is asking her, "So why are you there?" Again, she's already explained all this. He didn't listen to a single word she said. He asked for her name about 4 times during this call, because he never wrote it down the first time, apparently. She says, "I'm a caseworker. I'm doing a supervised visit for these children." And the dispatcher is saying, "You can't supervise your own visit." Like, he's not understanding that she's the caseworker and she brought the children to the parent to supervise the visit. He's totally getting all this wrong, and he's pretty much arguing with her, which, why does it matter? She's calling for help, saying, "Hey, I need the police to get down here. Some children's lives are in danger." She tells him, "I smelled gasoline, and the children are crying, and the guy slammed the door in my face." At about 6 minutes and 30 seconds into the call, okay, 6 minutes and 30 seconds, he says, "I'll dispatch the first available officer, but right now they're responding to real emergencies," or they're responding to life-threatening situations. And she says, "This is a life-threatening situation. This is life and death. You need to do something." She even goes on to say, "I'm pulling my car out of the driveway because I'm a little afraid for my life because I smelled gasoline." This doesn't key the 911 operator off at all. He has zero regard for anything she said. Then you have a second 911 call. And what happened in between these two 911 calls is the house exploded into flames. Okay? Understand that while she was dorking around with this first 911 operator and he did nothing for her, the house blew up right after that call. So the second call to 911, it's a little better, but not much. But they're at least listening to her and understanding what she's saying. She gets transferred because they're like, "Oh, are you calling about the fire on blah, blah, blah?" She's like, "Yeah, I'm calling about the fire, but I'm not calling about that. I'm calling about how there's a father and 2 children in the house." And so she has to re-explain the entire scenario. They finally get around to dispatching a police officer, and it takes that cop 13 minutes to arrive. So this is literally almost 20 minutes later before they get a cop there, when a parent has taken their kids into a home and this caseworker's attempted to report it. It's just insane. And if you want to go out and listen to that 911 call, it's out on YouTube.
But the takeaway is that, and we've had people already writing to us and saying, "I mean, what do you think about this caseworker? What do you think about the 911 operator?" But I mean, the 911 operator is the one with the problem here. They're the one that didn't do their job.
I mean, the caseworker is doing her job. She didn't have a say in whether this was a home visit or the daycare visit. she's just doing what she's told, and she's been told this is a home visit. So she's done a million of these. This is her job. And she's trying to do it the best she can. Sure, she should have been right there with the kids when they ran up to the door, but nobody's expecting something like this to happen. And not to the 911 operator's credit, but no one expects what happened to have happened. But still, when someone calls the police for help, the dispatcher needs to understand that it's not, you know, I know they get a million calls that are all bogus. I know people call because McDonald's is out of chicken sandwiches, but two children seem to be distressed, screaming, crying, and she smells gasoline. And this is the prime suspect in his wife's disappearance. Oh, I have one more thing to say about the 911 system. Most of the 911 dispatchers have a list of addresses that are known hazards, known issues. And at no point was Josh's address ever added to that, you know, like kind of a watch list. If you get a call about this address or from this address, you need to dispatch a cop immediately. But we usually save those for drug houses anyways.
You would think just her describing having smelled gasoline, her being prevented from seeing the kids when she's supposed to be there for a supervised visit, that should be pretty serious. But apparently with this 911 operator, yeah, it didn't matter.
Now, they did not have prior knowledge to this, but that same day, Josh had sent an email out saying, "I'm sorry, goodbye."
Yeah, the emails were sent out about 20 minutes before. It's according to what I read, it was, "I am not able to live without my sons, and I'm not able to go on anymore. I'm sorry to everyone I've hurt. Goodbye." And I mean, is that an admission, do you think, Justin?
I won't say that it's an admission about Susan's disappearance, but it's definitely an admission about his intentions of what he was about to do.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think if you reach, you might sense that maybe he does have some regret for hurting his wife. But then again, it's not expressly detailed in there. So, I mean, when he talks about everyone he's hurt, maybe he's only meaning he hurt his own family. Because they go into this house and they do investigate this explosion, when he says that he's sorry for everyone he's hurt, I mean, we know what he did inside that house. He went after his own kids with a hatchet.
Yeah, they find, they do autopsies on all of them. And the two boys had been struck in the neck and head with a hatchet before the fire broke out.
And, you know, and I think to myself, if he was just trying to take his kids with him, he could have just ignited the house as he was going to do anyway.
He could have just ignited the house with himself in there and not taken the kids down with him, but you know.
Right. But I'm saying, like, going after your kids with a hatchet, that's.
Yeah. How is this a more humane? I don't know what he's thinking in his head, but he murders his children before he blows the house up.
You know, as I went through this case and, you know, I'm really putting a lot of weight on Susan's words. And there are many of them because she had kept information where she worked and she had these diaries. She had sent emails off to people that she trusted. She really details how her husband went from being this really loving guy, you know, with issues, to a guy who was very, very cold and mean, even carried on other relationships, really just kind of kept her at arm's length, but controlled everything she did. And I wondered if he has mental health issues.
Well, there's actually a whole interview with the psychiatrist that gave him the evaluation that's out there. It's about an hour long. And this guy just talks about how everything out of Josh's mouth was about control, about him having control.
And so what are we dealing with here, Justin?
I would say narcissist had a screwed up life, had a screwed up father. And decided to take out all of his aggressions on his family.
You know, it's interesting that it was back when he and his wife moved away from his dad that it seemed like he may have been able to get away from him for a bit, but he always went back to his dad. And you wonder, even knowing that his dad was obsessed with his wife, that didn't bother him enough to cut off ties with him. And, you know, there was another guy who Josh really felt was interested in Susan. That was a problem for him. But when it came to his own dad, well, forgive and forget, right?
Yeah, apparently.
A lot of forgetting.
Yeah, I would say that he was in cahoots with his father when his father was sentenced for the voyeurism and child pornography. He was given the option to get a lesser sentence if he, I don't know, helped the courts out with other cases, and he refused. So his father took the full brunt of the sentence. Another aspect there of the family ties between Josh and his father.
There's been a lot of speculation with what happened with Josh and his father and even his brother Michael during that time in December.
With the rental car at the airport.
With the rental car, with, you know, his father calling into work. And then, you know, and it came out later that Michael had disappeared for about a week during that time between like the 4th and the 12th. He was just gone. And, you know, people had said that out of all of the Powells, that Michael was the most reasonable one. That he seemed like he was the most normal, because Alina was the one that was always just following everyone around and trying to please them, agreeing with everything. And I would say I don't agree with this whole picture, because Jennifer was the one that seemed to be the most normal to me. Sure, Michael was the one that seemed to be Mr. Successful and all this and that, but
where's Michael now? Can we talk to Michael about what happened when he disappeared for that week?
Since Michael Powell had disappeared for a while during that same stretch of time, you know, the authorities were wondering if he was involved maybe with his dad and his brother, the disappearance of Susan Powell. He had a car. It was a Ford Taurus, a 1997 silver Ford Taurus. He sold it to a salvage yard for $100. And so when the police finally found out about this selling of this car, and because they suspected he might have had something to do with the disappearance of Susan Cox, Powell, they found the vehicle, but it had been stripped of certain parts. And these parts were the right front passenger door, taillights, steering components, and some other parts. So they bring in a cadaver dog, searched around the vehicle, and when it got to the rear portion of the car, the dog sat. And what does that indicate, Justin?
That it smells death. These cadaver dogs are really honed in on the human smell of death, and it wasn't hitting on any other cars. It was just this one.
So the police go and interview Michael, and they ask him about his car, and he doesn't tell them the truth. The police let them dig his own hole and then inform him, hey, we know all about your car.
We have it.
So Michael was trying to lie his way out of that one. They swab the car. They're trying to get DNA evidence, and they can't get a match for Susan's profile. So they asked him, if you knew what happened to Susan, would you tell us? And Michael answered,
absolutely not. Wow.
These guys don't give in to any kind of pressure, do they, Justin?
And that answer is more of an admission than anything else that we've talked about in this case so far.
Now, Justin, you were talking about the life insurance policies earlier, or at least that came up in our discussion. And Josh Powell had named his brother Michael as the primary beneficiary in the life insurance policy on Susan Powell. And that was a $3.5 million life insurance policy.
And it was just, I think it was 9 days after the explosion at the house that all of the Powells were fighting over this life insurance policy. Yeah.
Well, he's definitely part of this investigation. They're trying to get him to talk. It's not working. On February 11th, and this is at 2:25 p.m., Michael Powell jumped from the multi-story Center Village, which is a complex, a seven-story parking structure. He just jumped off. And there's no explanation. He didn't leave a note. He didn't leave any voicemails. He just jumped off and died on impact.
I think we can speculate.
I know sometimes, you know, the people will say, but you don't have any. No, this guy was willing to jump what, 6-7 stories
to his
high,
death.
Yeah, down to his death. And for what? I mean, he was about to be rich, right?
Yeah.
And prior to that, the court had denied him $1.5 million in life insurance payout. And so it's very similar, I think, to what Josh did, where Josh wasn't able to get the custody of his kids that he wanted. Things didn't look good for him. And he left that voicemail to his family that said, you know, goodbye. I feel like Michael did the same thing. Things weren't going his way. He wasn't going to get that money. And the police were applying all this pressure on him. And so even though he was holding strong and saying, absolutely not, no, got too much for him and he couldn't take it.
So we have Josh, who took the lives of his children, allegedly is involved with the disappearance of his wife. We have his father, who goes to prison for just being a POS. And then we have his brother, who is now taking his own life, plausibly to avoid this investigation that was coming after him in the disappearance of Susan Powell.
This is a very, very sad story, Justin, but yeah. It's also crazy.
This, I was going to say at the beginning, but I didn't want to give it away, but anyone that's seen the documentary, Dear Zachary, this is very reminiscent of it, in the fact that this other family is trying to get custody of these children and the system is just not going along with what is right, what should happen, because apparently their hands are tied by policy, you know. But since this case, the Cox family has now tried to lobby for, tried to influence law that's about child custody and grandparents getting custody. Hopefully more red flags. I mean, in this case, because law enforcement never charged Josh, because they never even said he was a suspect, the court systems aren't going to say, take his children away. Even, I guess, hindsight's 20/20, but even when there's clear and present danger, that's, to me, very obvious. But
well, and I don't know. There are a lot of failings here, but on the other hand, I can see where you can't totally blame them. You know, they do move on the kids and they try to get them somewhere safe after Steve Powell's dirty secrets are exposed. I really feel like they should not have allowed him any kind of visitation. And that's where they're caught. We've covered different missing persons cases like Kyron Horman, and everyone believes they know who took Kyron and who made him disappear, but the authorities cannot charge that person. They don't have enough. And we can speculate, we can look at the timelines and say, come on, this fits. But the police really have to get it right. You know, and I was recently talking to a homicide detective, and he told me, he said, you can't just move on someone because they make the best suspect. You have to be able to dot your I's and cross your T's, because they need to get this through the court system too. A lot of these detectives don't want to just send a case to court because they can. They want to make sure they're sending a case that they know they're on the right side of, you know, because otherwise this investigation is not over.
It was 2 years after Susan's disappearance, and it didn't appear that they had any more information or evidence at that point. So I'm thinking there's no movement. They're not going to do anything. And when somebody in my family, one phone call about marijuana gets a child ripped out of the home within hours, I'm just thinking, really? The guy's a person of interest in the disappearance of his wife, and that's not enough to get anyone to move, at least for the custody of his children. And that's the part that reminds me of Dear Zachary, is she was the prime suspect in the husband's murder. And it's just like, are you kidding me? To me, it's a clear and present danger, but other priorities in this country of what we consider dangerous.
Well, but he has his rights. The thing that disturbs me, though, is that Josh didn't even try to keep up, really, for more than 15 minutes, any sense that he was concerned about Susan's whereabouts. That's what I just don't get. I get that you need more evidence to move on someone. They have their rights, but I mean, Josh never even seemed concerned. I mean, the police would ask him, please just hop in the car with us, point the way. We just want to know where you went camping. And he wouldn't do it. He would just get quiet. I don't understand that. like Dear Zachary, you have some grandparents who are doing the best that they can. All along the way, they've tried playing chess. They've tried making the right moves. They really wanted to get these kids under their care because the kids were acting out more and more. They knew they were having issues because of their time spent with Josh and Steve Powell. There was one point where one of the kids was holding the other kid's head underwater. And it's a frightening thing to witness for family members to see that. They could tell that these kids were disturbed. And then Charlie was starting to speak more and more as time went on about his mom going missing. And one of the details that he eventually gave was that his mom was there at the camping trip, but she and Daddy got out of the car and went for a walk, and she never came back when Daddy came back. It's really a case about hopelessness, which is what Dear Zachary is all about. You have supposedly this system that's about justice, that's about protecting the innocent, but when it comes down to this case, we didn't see that. We saw little bits and pieces of it, but it was a family member. It was a friend. It was a caseworker that did her best. But all of these people were met with more powerful forces that prevented them from getting things done. The 911 operator, for instance. So there's no justice in this case. Susan Powell remains missing. And really, I really just want to call her Susan Cox at this point. Yeah. I mean, it sucks that she has to remain a missing person with Josh's last name. I mean, it's disgusting. You know, there's that note that she left behind in that safe deposit box where she was asking, please take care of my children.
She literally said, if I die, it was Josh. I mean, she doesn't write that, but
she is saying that.
That's right. What she's saying.
What did you tell me when we talked about this? We talked about this once before we recorded, and you told me something.
Well, I hate to say it because it's a downer, but the Powells won. They won this situation. They are the ones that got away with their master plan of death and destruction.
In 2017, Steve Powell was released after serving time for possession of child pornography. And he'll be under community supervision until June 2019.
And then he's back out in the public amongst us.
The Powells really did win.
I hate to say that, but that's how it feels to me. And I have all the sympathy in the world for the Cox family and what they had to endure, them having to hold back anger and play the game of, hey, we're your friends and we're your family and we don't believe that you're involved in our daughter's disappearance because we're trying to save our children, our grandchildren, every day. And then just to be accused of the things that they were accused of and have their daughter, who's obviously been murdered and disposed of, drugged through the mud. This Powell family is just, they're the worst of the worst.
Yeah, in the end, Josh, when he started going south, he exerted more and more control, and as this case really reached its end due to murder and suicide, it was still all about control, and it was the Powells who had it.
When it comes to bra shopping, it's all about finding the right fit for you, and there's only one lingerie brand that offers bra sizes in AA through G and half cup sizes. That's Third Love. Third Love uses thousands of women's measurements and super smoothing foam that creates bras that fit better and feel great. Most old school bras carry 15 sizes. Well, Third Love has 60 sizes, including half cups. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. To find the bra that's waiting for you, all you have to do is go out and try Third Love's Fit Finder quiz. It takes about 60 seconds from the comfort of your own home. It's so comfortable, you might forget you're wearing it. And if you don't like it, returns and exchanges are always free. This year, make the change that will change the way you think about bras. Go to thirdlove.com/Y now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your purchase. That's thirdlove.com/WHY. thirdlove.com/Y. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.